experience you got? I'm like,
yeah, yeah. I was, I started off like my very first job on any production on in narrative was, and I don't really do narrative anymore, was literally just like running hard drives from set to the editing house at the end of every shoot day and doing that like 5 days a week and just blocking in like 2 hours of my time every day to go to set, hang out, wait for the DIT to like finish dumping the cards, take the hard drive and drive it to the post house. And that was my first ever role in film production. A glorified courier was the role.
But again, how did you get it? Even that one, how did you get it? How did you find your way into that job? Do you recall?
I don't even remember. I think it was just a simple matter of I just emailed a bunch of production companies. I heard about it. And I said, look, I'm just looking for any entry level production assisting role, you know, anything in that sort of wheelhouse. And they were just like, oh, I mean, if you've got a car, you can do this. And I was like, I've got a car. Like, that's fine. So it's good difficult though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mate, good hustle. And I totally agree. I get people, you know, emailing me every other day going, have you got any, you know, and I'm like, not really. And it's not for, you know, lack of want to help people. It's just that you, as a commercial enterprise, it's very complex to train somebody up.
It is.
When, you know, you really need to be, you know, delivering and billing time and.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a risk too.
Mate, massive.
Yeah. Yeah. Bring people in. And we get emails like every couple of days, every 2 days, like just being like, oh, I'm a recent graduate from Griffith Film School, or I've just moved here from London and I do this. And I just can't even respond to like them. I get them so often. It's just like, you know, I don't know how to say to you, I'm sorry, we're not that big of a company yet. We just don't have the capacity to take people on in those sort of roles, really. It's super difficult.
It is super difficult. Yeah. And that's why, you know, it's going to be, it's up to me. You know, you got to literally get in and make stuff.
Yeah.
Because oddly, you know, people do actually look at your previous work. So you went from hard drive courier to behind the scenes EPK guy.
I did a bit of tutoring at QUT as well in screenwriting because they saw you've got a bit of extra sort of knowledge in this area. Come and teach the kids how to do writing dialogue and story structure, I think it was, something like that.
See, that additional study did pay for itself.
It did, yeah.
you can only connect the dots looking back.
Yeah. That's it, yeah, yeah.
So from doing that work and sort of realizing that it was cool, you got to see it, bit of fun, but probably not your main game. What happened next?
Well, I had a very difficult time, I guess, putting myself out there, I think, as a content creator. I think I found it really difficult to sort of tap in when my friends were like going, oh, I'm an editor and I can work as an assistant editor on this production. And then I can, you know, get hired full time as an editor at a production company somewhere else. I was like, well, you know, I don't really have those sort of entry level position sort of skills. Like, you know, you might have like a camera assisting role or like, those are the really employable stuff. So I was like, well, I don't know if I can handle getting like rejected like every single time I want to like reach out to a production company saying, can I do this, can I do this, can I do this? And so that fear of like rejection, I guess, after getting enough no's, I was like, well, I'm not gonna that's not gonna work. So I thought, well, I'll just do freelance work instead. And that like continual like not wanting to like apply for a full-time job somewhere because I was worried that A, I might lose opportunities if they came along, but B, feel like someone would go, why would I hire you? That like, you know, like lack of self-worth, I think it is. It was much easier for me just to go, well, I'll just work freelance for myself and I can't fire myself or I can't like reject myself. So I'll just, I'll just pitch myself to clients. And so I just kept on doing freelance work. And the natural extension of that, you know, in 2018, 2019 was forming a company because we were getting so much freelance work that we could just go, well, we should probably legitimize this and make it a proper, you know, company. And Stranger Films was born. That's how it happened, basically. It's just me just continually just being like, I'll just do a little bit more freelance work. I'll just do a little bit more freelance work. And that was it.
It is the natural progression, isn't it? Because you're like, well, I didn't, you know, you're not sure if it's going to work. And you're like, kind of keeps working.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm confused.
Yeah.
Am I now doing this? Is this a real thing?
You just continually keep failing upwards and it eventually pays off.
Failing upwards. Yeah. I see. I like that. That's...
Yeah. Yeah.
You have to put that in your memoirs, don't you? Yes.
Yeah. Exactly.
Fail up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that was fine. And it worked really well. And I guess we had enough like good productions come through that enough sort of stability of work that, you know, my partner at the time, you know, who's still my partner today, was working, you know, a little bit of freelance, you know, film work. And I was like, oh, do you want to do this editing for me? I've shot this thing and they want to edit it as well. Can you do the editing? Oh, I've got to go to shoot this thing. Do you want to come and like assist for me on the shoot? And so the two of us would go and shoot and edit stuff. And eventually, you know, there was enough work for me to be freelance full time. And there was enough work for her to be freelance full time. And that was pretty much it. And we've worked together and we co-founded the company together. And that's the way it's been.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Because yourself and your partner, so Genevieve.
Genevieve Laren. Yeah.
Yeah. So you guys started that together after. Yeah, so that freelancing journey, yeah. Just going, hang on, I need more help.
Yeah, yeah.
I need another set of hands.
Please.
I'd rather shoot than edit.
Yeah, exactly.
Is what I assume that you're saying there.
Yeah.
And then you've gone on to obviously make some very nice things. And some of the, look, one of the pieces that I did want to bring up was the work that you did that got you an award on Gruen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So for anybody listening outside of Australia, Gruen Transfer is a wonderful show about advertising. And it's called The Pitch, isn't it?
Yes.
Is the segment.
Yeah, that's right.
Where they get people to make a thing and submit a thing. And is it, you know, agencies are going head to head to try and win the brief.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that story.
There's been two of them. It's been a great experience both times. The pitch is as you said, like they're basically given a brief of like usually something really weird or difficult, you know, put a positive spin on natural disasters, which is the one we did recently, which of course you always want to get the one that that is the harder one to do, because if you pull it off, you're probably, you know, guaranteed the win. And so, you know, we did that one most recently, and we had a lot of fun with that. We were brought in by Queensland Youngbloods, which is like the up and coming like marketing group for young people who work in marketing. And there's a Youngbloods sort of like group in, you know, in each of the sort of states or in a lot of the states. And a lot of the time they'll pitch Youngbloods against another Youngbloods team. So this time it was Queensland versus WA, I think, is that who we were up against. And we tied for the win. We didn't technically like win. We still got an award, which is really cool. And oftentimes the Youngbloods, whenever they do the Youngbloods episode, it's always a tie. It's, you know, they just do it to keep people interested, I think. I don't know.
Do you get half a trophy?
I think the half a trophy would be more of a talking point. we got a full trophy, which is really cool. And, you know, we loved doing it with Youngbloods because they came up with some really cool creative ideas. And they brought us in to go, how can we make this? Like, you know, how can we actually put these ideas into a tangible sort of like piece of video?
Now, you got to educate me here. See, I know so little.
All right. That's so not true, by the way.
Young Bloods. Because this is not something that I'm today years old right now.
Yeah.
As I'm learning about this.
Yeah. Oh, so it's like just an up and coming like collective, I guess is the right word. Like it's sort of like a, you know how there's like the ACS for cinematographers, yeah. This cinematographer society. This is like the marketing equivalent of that. So if you're like a young gun who, you know, works at like, you know, Ogilvy or the Monkees or any of these biggest sort of agencies, and you're like, I want a bit of mentorship. I want to like, you know, network with other young up and coming marketing people. Shout out to Youngbloods. They're awesome. They're really, really cool. And it's all run by the members and they're all pretty much, you know, 30 or younger. So it's all sort of, you know, 20 to 30 year olds. If you're in marketing, which probably people in watching this might be, definitely join up. They're a great group.
See, that's fantastic. So I'm too old to be a young blood. Is there like a middle-aged bloods?
Mid-bloods? Yeah.
Mid-bloods. We probably need to look at that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm definitely like, I've just hit the age cap. I think on the last one we did, you know, but technically I'm not in Youngbloods. It's they hired us as a company to make it for them.
Gotcha. Is there an age range in terms of people that are involved in it?
No, they can hire whatever company they want to actually shoot the thing.
Gotcha.
But for the young bloods, it's usually 30 and below.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so it really is for people getting started.
Totally, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's a lovely thing to be able to recommend. I'll make sure we put a link to that.
Definitely.
In the show notes. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Because it's this sort of stuff, and this is actually my favorite part about getting people in and just talking to them about their expertise and their journey.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just all these crazy things that you learn.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, never even heard of.
Yeah, yeah. I'd never heard of it before until one of them had like contacted us out of the blue and has said, "Oh, we've got no budget. We've got like shoestring budget to shoot this thing." Because it's an ABC show, and it's also a segment on an ABC show, and it's also the junior version of the segment on the ABC show. So your budget funnel is going like this. Like
you have $1.
Yeah, it's really really low. But in terms of like TVC land, you know, it evaporates real quick.
Oh, absolutely. There's yeah, well, we're all used to those.
Yeah.
Those problems. It doesn't stretch far in this world.
That's it.
So from setting up and running your own company, I mean, how did that go once you really formalized it and put it out there and, you know, you're working together in a partnership?
Yeah.
How was that experience? What did the first 12 months feel like at that?
Well, we incorporated in 2019 as a sort of financial requirement of receiving a bit of grant money from Screen Queensland, and we were like, it's going to be a lot simpler if we're just a company, and that way we can put the money through the company and look, it's about time we do it anyway, because we've been doing so much freelance work that it makes much more sense. And so we basically, like, you know, set that up and started paying ourselves a super super low wage, basically just what we needed just to pay rent, pay for groceries, and just live until we could build up a bit of cash flow. And then 2020 came along, and at the end of the first year of business, COVID hits, and we're like, cool. Yeah.
Good.
We've been in this office space, and we started off in Creative Enterprise Australia at QUT, which is like a small business incubator. We were originally right next door to Ludo Studios, which is the company that makes the TV show Bluey, which I'm sure you know, which I'm sure a lot of viewers will know. And like us, they started off with, you know, two people in a room, and now they're like one of the most successful companies in Queensland, probably the most successful like screen company in Queensland, and have one of the most successful TV shows, kids TV shows in the world, if not the most successful, I'd say. And so, you know, we started off, you know, next door to them in this little small business incubator with a little office with just me and Jen and one of the two other people like working alongside us. And we have just been growing and growing and growing. And now we have an office in the Valley, still just one street away from Ludo, which is really nice. Going through COVID was really difficult because we had to, like, I guess, pivot away from shooting in real life. You know, as a lot of people watching this will know, it disrupted a lot of companies. We did a lot of like editing and a lot of animation. We did like some live streaming. We lost, I know the day that they announced the like gathering restrictions in Queensland, we lost $50,000 worth of work in one day, which for us was pretty daunting. We literally had like three emails come through being like, it's canceled. Which was just savage. But then on the back of that, one of the events went from being a little like, oh, we're just going to show up and shoot highlights for a couple of days, to being like the first event in Australia, from what I know, the first major event in Australia to be pivoted entirely online digitally. So CODE, Q-O-D-E, was a big tech festival that was on in Brisbane, and we basically like 2 weeks out had to pivot entirely to be from a full physical event at the convention center to an entirely online virtual, like, you know, 24 hours of streaming basically over like 3 days. So bit of a task.
That's pretty full on.
Yeah.
That's a reasonably big change of brief.
Yeah, totally.
Short notice as well.
Yeah. I mean, it went from I think like a 5 to 10K job to like a 50 to 60K job in the space of like 24 hours. And so we had to hire a bunch of people to help us produce it and help, you know, get camera operators and organize gear packages and stuff and just scope out like how the hell we were going to do it. Because like live streaming just wasn't really a big thing yet at this time. This is, you know, March 2020, I think it was. So
I remember that time vividly on my desk here is the A10 Mini I bought at that specific point in time when I believe most of Australia and the world also attempted to buy streaming components.
Blackmagic rubbing its hands together.
Blackmagic did all right out of all that. That took a minute to arrive. Mm. But it was one of the issues was all the work that we do where we would turn up. Now, there's a bit of rain in Brisbane this afternoon.
Yeah.
I can see Tony looking for hail. He's worried his car's
going. I am a bit worried. It's fine. I'm sure it's fine.
I'm sure it's insured. What could possibly go wrong? Mm.
Just Queensland things.
Just Queensland things, yes. When you get those hail afternoons, they can be a little bit brutal.
Mm.
Yeah, my four-wheel drive's parked outside too, so I just quietly hope. I hope that we don't get flogged.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty big change going into 2020. So flipped your business model.
Yeah, for like 6 months, 12 months, however long it was. And we did still get shooting, and we did get a bunch of live streaming jobs. And we came out of the other side. And I say to people, if you can survive COVID, you can survive anything. Yeah, that was brutal. We got a whole bunch of like new clients out of that work, people trying new types of content. You just pivot, you innovate, you try new stuff. Luckily, one of the benefits of, being a super, super new company was we were small. We didn't have any overheads. We just signed a lease on a new office, really. Like, 2 months or 3 months into COVID, we got kicked out of QUT because they closed the office space down, which was a bit brutal. We found this place in the valley and we were like, yeah, put down a deposit. We're like, we can get it now. We can just ride it out. And we did, and we have, and we're still in the office, which is great. And we managed to get through it, but it was difficult. Yeah.
So you really do need that wild self-belief, don't you? Yeah. Delusional is the correct term.
That's the hashtag coming out of this episode.
Yeah,
delusional. Hashtag delusional.
Well, maybe, you got to believe and you got to create things that don't exist. That's part of the type of person that I enjoy chatting to.
Tenacious might be. Maybe that's a nicer way.
I like that. We can hashtag tenacious. Do you know my problem? I might struggle to spell it.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, all right. I'm just laughing at my own jokes here. Now, Tony, one of the things that I was very interested to talk with you a little bit further today was you sort of posted something which, triggered this whole conversation today about your creative journey and, your own personal desire to make things and the way that that works and, what inspires you and being able to, I guess, retreat back and find ways forward.
Mm.
I'm super interested just to hear this whole story.
Okay.
Like, where did it start? What happened?
I'm going to give you a little bit of backstory here because I think it's really important. One of the things that I guess that sort of like set me on this path was that we made this like comedy pilot and we got a lot of like positive affirmation afterwards, and we got a lot of yeses and then suddenly a lot of nos, and this is during COVID as well. We basically made this thing and we were like, we think this is really cool. And then we there was a whole bunch of like, there was a big old shift in the world. There was a big old shift in the world that changed the market pretty rapidly. And we had a whole bunch of interest in this thing and we put a lot of time and effort into this pilot. And then it just stalled out. And a lot of the world got disrupted by COVID and by, other things and people's viewing habits changed a lot as well. And suddenly, a lot of the sort of like interest we had just dried up overnight. And we went from feeling on top of the world to feeling in the pits, absolutely just savage. When you put a lot of effort and time, as people will know, when you put a lot of time and energy into a business or into a creative project, only to have it sort of stall and not sort of progress, you feel a bit shit. It makes you feel a bit shit. And that's really hard to get out of. When you spend a lot of time in film, writing stuff, and every time you go to write stuff, you go, how are you going to make it? Who's going to pay for it? Who's going to watch it? And when you suddenly have all of these like, producer questions sort of rattling around in your brain, it's very hard to turn that off when you're writing. As someone who's written a lot all through school and then university and then through, Screen Queensland grants of various sort of, sizes and scopes, you get really used to writing things for other people. You get really used to your creativity being a commercialized sort of product, and that is really the antithesis to good creativity. It's very, very hard to break out of that institutionalized sort of way of thinking, and it's very detrimental to being a creator, because creating things, you know, films, TV shows, writing books, whatever you want to do, creation is just an act of pure will. It's really like, as you know, like you've got to be so bloody self-motivated and tenacious that you just go one day, I think I'd like to make a film about this. And then 18 months later, that film exists. And if we just skip through all the really difficult stuff, the thing that's keeping that engine running is that sort of like little burning sort of flame inside you that goes, I want to make this thing. And you might want to make it because you want to tell that story, or because, you know, it's based on real events that are super important to you, or it's just a topic you think is interesting, a story that needs to be told. But that little like belly fire has to like really go keep the engine going. Otherwise, the project just doesn't go forward. And if you lose that fire, if you know, the coals sort of burn really low, suddenly your like desire to like make things just dries up completely, and it affects everything. And when you are employed in film, you know, in the screen industry broadly, if you haven't got that sort of burning creative passion to like, you know, to try things, to experiment with things, to tell stories, and to try something new, it affects everything. Your commercial work, which is your livelihood, and you know, maybe your partner's livelihood as well, in my case. So you've got to find ways of keeping that bloody fire alive. And so over the course of like about 2 years after COVID, and you know, through that period, I was feeling pretty down the dumps. Around about the same time, my friend invited me to play Dungeons and Dragons. And little did I know at the time, that would be the thing that actually like got me out of my funk. We did this like campaign with my friend Josh O'Donnell, who's a sound recordist. He works in the industry. And I'll be forever thankful for him to introducing me and a bunch of other friends of ours into this thing. And this is before Stranger Things like popularized D&D, and it had its big like renaissance, which is happening at the moment. And for those people that don't know, D&D is a tabletop game that is, you know, sort of halfway between like improv comedy, role play, gambling with PG rating, and like Warhammer. Like it's sort of like an intersection of like, you know, board games and comedy improv, basically. It's a load of fun. But I was just playing that campaign with him, you know, once every couple of weeks we'd play. And it was on the back burner for a while, and I had a good time. And then my friend said to me, my friend Matthew Sawyer, who's an editor, he said to me, Tony, you've got to give DMing a go. And DMing is like where you play as the dungeon master, or you like write all of like the world, or maybe you adapt some existing works, or you pick up a module and you come up with a story and the character, and you help come up with the characters with your players, and you basically run the game. And you have to like write beforehand and then improvise on your feet and narrate in real time the things that are happening in the game. If you've ever watched people play D&D, it's a magnificent thing to watch, because it's a real, like, it's like watching improv, where the people can just come up and just sort of yes and with each other, but then in like a Lord of the Rings sort of like setting, sitting around a table, sinking a few beers, telling a few jokes, and just rolling a few dice. And that sort of like simple, like stupid sort of like pastime became something really, really magical to me, because I, you know, made this sort of death pact with my friend Sawyer, and he said, you've got to do a one shot, just do a one shot, which is like a standalone thing. And do that, and I'll do one as well, and it'll get us out of this like creative funk. And so I did it, and I had such a bloody like great time making this one shot, which was just this sort of like stupid David Bowie like reference inspired like, you know, thing, you know, set in like a sort of like wizard school, basically, and it was sort of like a murder mystery sort of thing. And I had such a great time writing this thing that I was like, at the end of it, I was like, do you guys want to do some more of this? Like, do you want to do another? Would you be keen on episode two? And there was a resounding hell yeah, because everyone had such a great time. And this is all like, you know, all film people that I got in, like, you know, Josh, who's the guy who introduced me, and Sawyer, and a bunch of other people who play, who I actually work with as well. And because they're all film people, they're all massive nerds. They're all very creative. And they're all very charismatic as well in their own sort of way, which is a fantastic recipe for D&D. And what started as like a one-off thing turned into 80 hours or more of gameplay of us over the course of probably 12 months, 12 sessions. Each one was like 6 or 7 hours of gameplay at a time on a Sunday afternoon. I probably wrote the equivalent of like a small fantasy novel, like 50 to 70,000 words, which I had no even like thought that I could even write that beforehand. That sounds so daunting to me. And before I knew it, I'd just done it because there's no outcome for it. That was a very long-winded sort of way of explaining what had happened.
Well, that was exactly what I wanted to hear, was because what you've touched on there is the fact that we've got these, you know, creative gifts that we decide to, you know, take ideas and make them exist.
Mm.
And, you know, as you, you know, initially you're just confused when people say yes, that sounds good.
Yeah.
You're like, really?
Yeah.
But then when you do it, you know, over a, you know, number of years.
Yeah.
You do get into a bit of a formula.
Mm.
Like, you know what's going to work and you sort of know what'll probably land and reasonably safe.
Yeah.
And it does take some of the zing out of it.
I mean, one of the things I really liked about that was as a writer, you get to sort of like just write something either before the session starts. You maybe have written like a scene and you might do like an opening monologue. It sort of explains the situation and maybe like narrates it. Like it's like basically writing like a film script, but it's prose. And you have to make it super engaging just to bring people into the episode, basically, as like a little intro explaining where they are, what's happening, you know, maybe doing little character voices as well. And being able to instantly write something and then play it out, it's like doing a table read for like a feature film. You know, how you get actors around and you do like a table read. And you get to see exactly whether or not the joke landed, whether or not the descriptions are on point, whether or not some of the dialogue, you know, landed with people, make people go, oof, you know, whether or not it had tension and gravitas. And you can instantly go, cool, that worked. And then the next time you can do that again or change it up and try something different. And that immediate, like, writing on the fly and, you know, to get the feedback straight away. Because normally in film, it takes ages. You got to sit down and write a 100-page screenplay. And then, you know, maybe a producer will read it. Maybe they'll pretend they read it. And then maybe you're like, if you get enough actors interested, you maybe do a table read like months later, and you don't get that sort of feedback. And maybe you'll do drafts and someone will go, oh, I liked the first act, but the second act needs work. And there's such a like lack of screenwriting culture here in Australia, that getting that type of like reciprocation, sort of like positive energy back from writing and through the drafting process is super, super difficult.
I'm going to throw you right under the bus here. Have you got a scene that you can think of to paint me a picture? Because I am D&D noob. I'm totally lost and I can't really, like, I think I sort of get it.
Yeah.
But I can't visualize it. So
you can just literally just imagine like Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit is the common sort of like backdrop for most D&D things. But that's just your vanilla, like high fantasy type setting. And so if you've ever watched a TV show like that or a film like that, that's pretty much what D&D is, where each of the people sitting around the table play as a different person. So you might have someone, you know, playing as like a wood elf ranger, and someone playing as like an old wizard, and someone playing as like a, you know, a sort of, you know, grumpy dwarf. And so each person has that character and they play as a party, right? They all like are as a party. And then the dungeon master's role is to basically just describe what is happening in real time. And then explain the ramifications of any things they have to do. So, for example, they might start off and say, you know, you've all started off, you've all begun in a tavern. This tavern is this great sort of old dwarven sort of like, you know, drinking hole. And in the center of this tavern is this great big sort of like hole in the ground that, you know, is as deep as you can possibly imagine, is just bottomless pit basically in the middle of the tavern, and people are throwing like food and drink into this tavern. You hear these like sort of like screams and shouts from the depths, and then, you know, they might describe like the bartender comes over to you and it's this tall like orcish lady with this, you know, hair sort of like pulled back and sort of like braids, and she says to you, right, what do you have? And then they have to like respond. And then they might want to like do something. They might want to say, you know, they want to do persuade the barkeep to like give them a, you know, accommodation for the nights. And I go, okay, cool. Roll a persuasion for that. and they'll roll some dice, and maybe their character is real sort of like, you know, savvy and a fast, smooth talker, and they might have like a bonus to that. And so they might get like a 15 or like a 20 or something, and usually that means it's a success. They might roll a one, and the, you know, the bartender might say, tell them to jog on. So it's really like they roll dice to determine the outcomes of what they want to do in the game. It's a load of fun because you have no idea where the game is going to go. You might have like some broad sort of like structure of like, oh, they might want to go here and do a scene here. My game went from being in the first episode like a sort of murder mystery whodunit, you know, David Bowie sort of meets Harry Potter sort of like scenario, to a monster that was like living underneath a mining town that was like that nobody could see because it was like it had some like psychic feel on it. There was this train robbery episode that was like a real like Wild Wild West sort of like steampunk train robbery episode, to, you know, them in the desert being basically like sentenced to death at the hands of like this phoenix god that like lived in this volcano. So like it's really like it can be anything you want it to be. And I made, you know, like maps, you know, like battle maps and like world maps and like wrote all the characters and the NPCs and stuff in the game. It's loads of fun. Highly recommend.
See, that's really cool. And,
yeah.
And what you've done there is, again, you've painted me a picture and you've drawn me into that story.
Yeah.
And see, then I can imagine it. I can see it. I can visualize it. I can, and I can see where that can get you along. And then obviously that roll of the dice,
yeah,
to see which way the story will go.
Yeah.
Yeah. What a fascinating thing, because it's not something I'd done before.
Oh, highly recommend. Yeah. If you can ever play D&D, I, as a creative, it's probably the most creatively rekindling sort of like thing that I've ever done. Definitely worth doing.
Well, I can hear that. I can hear it in the way that you speak about it.
Yeah.
And how has that come through into your commercial work? Have you noticed a change?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that one of the things that D&D has done is just the confidence just to write things that I think people will enjoy, and really thinking about story structure. Even if it's a 30-second ad, knowing there's a beginning, middle, and an end, knowing that you need tension and you need conflict. You know, maybe not in a comedy commercial, you might not want to do that, but you know, conflict and tension is the you know, the cornerstone of any good piece of screen content. And you know, giving everyone like clear goals, you know, because obviously if you're doing this, you know, you need to have goals. You need to know that Aragorn wants to, wants to become king, and that Frodo has to destroy the ring. Everyone has to have you know, tangible goals they want to achieve. And then bringing that into screenwriting, you go, well, some of the most popular TV shows that are out there at the moment are basically just D&D campaigns. They might be skinned differently. They might be a science fiction, or they might be, you know, like a superhero, like Marvel thing. But it's all the same. It's literally all the same skills as a writer. And if anyone, you know, wants to become a showrunner, particularly, that's the real like crossover of skills, I think, is to be able to, you know, really understand the sort of long-term arc of things. But to answer your question more specifically, I think it's just a matter of just keeping your brain elastic, keeping your brain active and being able to think of things on the fly. Because, I mean, in D&D, you have to improvise heaps. There's this really important need to, if someone's, you know, like throws something out, you've got to be able to take it, respond, and throw it back even better and bigger and more interesting and funnier. You've got to be able to yes and, basically. I've been doing like recently creative pitches with clients where they've gone, oh, hey, here's the brief, you know, blah, blah, blah. And instantly my D&D brain has turned on, or this part of my creative brain has turned on, and I've gone, oh yeah, you could totally just do this. And I've just like come up with like an idea for an ad that I go, we should make that. That's great. Like it's, and not to like toot my own horn, but I feel like I wouldn't have been able to do that beforehand, where I can just like improv like my first idea and be like, oh yeah, that'd work as a scene because it's this and this. Yeah.
Sounds like it's actually had a fairly major effect.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think so. I have read about it more recently, looking into it, and the terminology that some people have called it is passion stacking. When a little story for you, when David Bowie first came onto the scene, you can tell I'm a bit of a David Bowie nerd. When David Bowie first came into the scene in the 1960s, I think it was, or you know, whenever, 1970s even, he came in and wasn't very popular. everyone was like, who's this sort of like skinny sort of, you know, dorky sort of dude with the pale sort of complexion and the sort of weird teeth. And, you know, he's a bit of a sort of like oddball character. He isn't quite sure of himself. He sort of disappeared off the music scene for a couple of years and went away and did a whole bunch of like creative, like personal development in his skills, went and did like, you know, fashion and film and writing and stuff. And basically just threw himself into other forms of art, came back and exploded in popularity. When he gave music that second crack after doing all these other things first, he was so much more interesting as an artist because of his, like, you know, suddenly he's got all these like interesting costumes and, you know, this makeup and this like on stage, like charisma was there and his ability to like put on a show, and his music was so much more like experimental and sort of strange, and his writing, his lyrics were just so much more poignant. And it was only after that time of being, I guess, rejected, going and doing that sort of like passion stacking and then, you know, building up his enjoyment of other things, that he could really rekindle that fire and come back onto the scene and absolutely explode in terms of his own like main sort of interest, which is music.
See, I hadn't heard that story before.
It's interesting. It's really compelling as well.
And passion stacking, like, is that a verified term? Is there a book around that?
You
is
can this... look it up. Yeah. Apparently, that's the phrase that people refer to as is passion stacking, where your fondness for one hobby can fuel your fondness for another, and then that can fuel your creativity broadly, and then that can be brought into your work or into your other passions.
See, that's really interesting, because I think the passion stacking, and this is what one of the reasons I was interested to talk to you about it, is I'm doing the same thing.
Yeah,
because, you know, I'm a stills photographer.
Yeah.
From way back.
Yeah,
and then, you know, have moved into obviously other parts of it.
Mm.
But I found myself at a point where I didn't even want to pick up a camera.
Yeah.
Anymore.
Yeah.
And I found that to be very strange.
Why is that, do you think?
Because at the peak of my stills career, I was shooting north of 250,000 frames a year, and I did that for somewhere in the realm of 7 to 9 years.
That's wild. That's heaps.
Yeah. So I did that and then sort of went into film, which is, I guess, where our lives intersected.
Yeah.
And actually, I know exactly what it is. It's when, you know, I've had the chance to do some bigger things and probably things that I never expected I would do. And I sort of did those. And once I realized I could, like once I realized I could make sort of bigger TV commercials and stuff, and I actually did it, you know, the other side of imposter syndrome where you've done it, then I didn't really know what to do anymore. Because I chased the goal all the way uphill.
Yeah.
The delusional, impossible, how on earth is this? Yeah. This will never happen.
Yeah.
And then you get there and you look around and you're like, crap, I'm actually doing this.
Yeah.
But you've fundamentally, like, you've honed that skill to such a point that, you know, you're not a beginner anymore.
No.
You're not winging it. You're not panicking on how on earth you're going to pull it off. You know.
Yeah.
And you're experienced and you can.
Yeah.
And I love learning. I love starting from scratch. One of the things I picked up more recently was I've always wanted to learn how to weld.
Oh, great.
And I've had a friend teach me sort of 2 years ago, and I haven't really done anything with it.
Yeah.
And I sort of went over the Christmas break. I had a free time and I went, look, if I'm going to do this, I got to keep doing it.
Yeah.
So I've jumped into that.
Yeah.
And I've been, you know, teaching myself welding at home.
Yeah.
And there's something really joyous for me in being a total amateur, not knowing what you're doing, and then not even knowing what you don't know.
Yeah.
And like having to Google the question, because one of the things I was doing was like my welds were porous and they had little holes in them.
Oh.
Which is bad.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, you're Googling, why does my weld have holes in it?
Yeah.
And you know, it was because I wasn't running the gas and I wasn't, you know, all these little things. Because you've got to, you know, you've got all these things you've got to finesse.
Yeah.
Which is not dissimilar to, you know, you go all the way back to shutter speed, ISO and f-stop.
Yes.
And you think about when you're starting, how hard it is to just balance those three. You know, people that will shoot little green square full auto. And then, you know, the finesse of learning how to shoot manual and then being able to do that without thinking.
Yeah,
being able to look at a scene and balance a scene without thinking. it's that.
Yeah.
It's going all the way back to that place of not knowing.
Back to basics.
Man, I love that place.
Yeah, it's a good place. And I think that the more that you do just the entry-level version of everything, the better you get at learning how to do things quickly.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, if you're picking up welding, you're also learning how you learn, and you're also learning how to find information on things. Like, I mean, I similar to welding, I picked up like airbrushing, because you know, and it's an extension. This is why D&D is such a good hobby, because you have your sort of like central hobby, and then you've got like other hobbies that like that maybe like orbit around it, like satellite hobbies. So like for me, I the D&D is the main one, but like around that is writing. And then around that is, you know, like there's like the little miniatures that you get as well, which I, you know, was like, where do I get these from? Oh, well, maybe I'll get into 3D printing. And so like from this, I've gone D&D is writing, D&D is 3D printing. And then I got to paint these as well now. So now I got to get back into painting. And so my number of like what I do outside of work now, my weeks are filled with all these other like hobbies. And then I'm like, well, I'm spending too much time sitting down. I better start going back to the gym as well. It's all grown out of that, but like learning how to like airbrush properly and researching that made me go, I can do things. And now like I can go, well, if I want to do, you know, renovations on the house, I feel like I taught myself airbrushing. Maybe I can teach myself how to lay floorboards down or paint walls and stuff. And I'm like, how hard could it be? It's fine, right? You're building up that confidence of like of your own ability to learn skills.
I think so. And learning to ask better questions, yeah. Learning to ask an informed question.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we've got the entirety of human knowledge at our fingertips. And
all the time, everywhere at 5G speeds.
Anything you want to know at any time, anywhere.
Yeah.
And I think our inquisitive nature just needs a little prod.
Yeah, yeah. It's only until you have that mission of what you need to find out that infinite well of knowledge can really actually be utilized. And it's overwhelming to be like, oh, I've got all this knowledge in my hand all the time. Why aren't I using it? But until you've got that like quest, what's the point?
You need the quest, the hero's journey.
That's right. Yeah, there's a theme here. This episode sounds like it was planned, right?
it kind of does, yeah. and we keep coming back to that. And I keep, it's funny how we sort of keep coming back to those arcs. And and you sort of said that, you know, anywhere you look, all the stories are the same.
Mm.
And you know, it's probably just a, you know, deep seated,
yeah,
human trait.
Yeah, it's also like something I've been saying to my partner, but also to my like cinematographer, and also to my my CBT coach, cognitive behavioral therapy coach, who I've just started seeing a CBT person, which has been really, really good for getting back on things and just having that sort of, you know, proactive sort of approach. But I said to them, I want to get back on the main quest. I've had these side quests, you know, like an RPG, you know, you play like a video game or something like that, and you have like side quests and side jobs that you can do. And you've got the main story that's often the most compelling and most interesting one. But the other ones are so much more low stakes, and they're so much easier to pick up and drop. And you can go, oh, cool. Well, instead of going and like knuckling down and bloody writing something I want to write and, you know, writing the next project I'm going to work on, it's going to be my like sort of, you know, pillar sort of project for me creatively. Oh, I think I'll just go and play some Age of Empires 2. Or maybe I think I'll go and, you know, I'll just go for a run. That'll make me feel better. And that, yeah, sure, maybe it will. But like, it's not the main quest. You know what I mean? And I think that like, it's so easy to sort of like fall off that path and just go, well, I'm just going to do this instead. Because life is so easy to be distracted by. Like, there's so many cool, fun, exciting things to do in life. And that's fine. Not like poo-pooing people that you know, get a lot of joy out of just you know, existing and just having a bloody great time living in the moment, which is terrific. But I have in the last like couple of months basically just been like, I've just got to just do the main thing I want to do and just put all my attention on that.
And what is that, you know, when you actually... On the other side, I mean, there's fit in there.
Yeah,
a lot of reflection, a lot of side quests. What's the main vision?
The main vision for me is, if you were to look like forward into the future, is I want to be a showrunner in film and television. You know, in television, film for showrunning, and maybe directing for films. And it's a really big goal. It's not an impossible goal, but it's difficult. And it's it's the sort of thing where I have created other goals to get me to that goal. One of the other goals, and it's only like you forget about these goals sometimes. You've got to really write these things down because you forget about them. You set them up and you start doing them and you go, oh, wait, what was the point of this? And one of them was to set up the company that we've set up because we needed a platform to be able to make things in a sustainable way. As we said at the beginning of this, filmmaking is expensive. If you don't have those resources and networks and collaborators that you can work with that want to come on the main quest with you, it's super, super difficult. You can't make film in a vacuum by yourself. There are some people who do a very good job of making films by themselves, but it's very, very, very difficult. You know, not everyone can be Robert Rodriguez, just, you know, one man banding this thing. So we were like, well, let's make a company so we can have an income. Let's have a platform so we can, you know, make content when we are ready to do so. It's here to do it. And we've done that now. We've got our stable incomes, you know, we've got that sort of like, you know, buildup of equipment, of cameras and lights and sound gear and that sort of thing. And if we want to go shoot stuff, if we want to go, oh, I'm going to make a proof of concept pilot for a TV show or you know, a pilot for a TV show or proof of concept for a film, we could do that, write it and go and shoot it in a weekend, come out and be like, hey, here, ABC, what do you reckon? Or Netflix or Stan, what do you reckon? And chances are that piece of content is going to be better than a whole lot of what established companies or what a whole bunch of like, you know, people on their own would be able to achieve because of the things you've taken, the steps you've taken along the way to get to this point.
I was recently reading Taylor Sheridan's story. And I'm not sure if you're familiar
with
that. So he is the man behind Yellowstone.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And it's very much that story. Part-time actor, little bit of writing, little bit of, you know, serving drinks.
Yeah, 100%.
As you do in that whole exercise.
Yeah.
You know, spent a lot of his time writing. But again, it wasn't until, you know, and because, again, a bit later in life for him where that show, that one show, that Yellowstone has totally transformed his trajectory.
Totally, yeah.
And brought him out of, because I was watching, Mayor of Kingstown the other day, and I saw that he's behind that as well.
Yeah.
And he's literally.
Oh, yeah. You have that one breakout, like, thing that comes along, suddenly everyone wants you. Bryan Cranston, great example of that. You know, like, he was on Malcolm in the Middle, and then, like, not a whole lot for a long time. Breaking Bad comes out, and now he's in everything. Like, he's you know, the it person. Lots of actors have that where they're just like off the radar for ages and then bam, they're suddenly in everything. Brendan Fraser is making a comeback, which is awesome.
Which is massive.
And yeah.
It's that David Bowie story again, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
You know, isn't this, you go off into the wilderness, isn't that the...
Yeah, yeah. You got to go find yourself a little bit and figure yourself out and figure out what stories you want to tell, I guess.
Because that's in the hero's journey, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. And like, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I really enjoy... I'm getting a little bit teary-eyed here, but like it's a little bit abstract as well, but it's I love that the hero's journey is almost like a philosophical view. It's a philosophy as well, because you can look at it and sort of go, well, I have to go through these trials to grow as a person so I can overcome my flaws and be a better person and be able to achieve the things I want to achieve, to bring a boon back to my family or to my people or to, you know, to my nation or whatever. And you've got to know that like everyone is on these journeys, and it's really, really fulfilling thing to know that, you know, we tell stories in that way because it reflects our own journeys.
I think that's key is that we see ourselves in this and the capacity to see ourselves in it. And I think that was why I was so interested to talk to you about this, because, you know, I've just had these conversations a lot recently.
Yeah.
With friends, and you know, because you know, I'm now, you know, mid 40s, and all the people that I started with, you know, when we were all whippersnappers, you know, hoping and dreaming, and, you know, with like literally nothing. We used to have our meetings at New Farm Park because we didn't have an office and we didn't have clients, and like, you know, we'd like shoot hoops and ride skateboards and like talk about, you know, the dreams of the business.
That sounds like sublime. To be honest, it sounds great. Honestly, like I love outdoor meetings and like hanging out.
They're the best. And the other night, I ordered a takeaway from the local Indian joint, and we used to go down there for lunch because we had a $9.95 special.
Yeah.
And again, because we didn't really have any clients.
Yeah.
We had plenty of time to go out for lunch.
Yeah.
And ordering that and having that. You know, it takes you back to like these very simple times where the dream of what we were hoping to create,
yeah,
you know, was really all that we had
carrying
us forward.
Yeah.
And it's the, actually, I think I remember this from Steve Jobs' story as well, where he talks about the, when he was sacked from Apple and he talks about the heaviness of the success.
Yeah.
And then the lightness of when he went on to create the company Next, which then led him back because he was sort of weighed down by, you know, that enormous success that he'd created, all the things that he set out to do in the first place.
Yeah.
And then he like had his ass handed to him. Mm. But he talks about that being one of the most creative periods of his life.
Yeah.
When it was just free and just doing.
When you're just untethered.
Untethered.
Untethered from responsibility and from expectations.
Yeah.
It's really hard to untether yourself from things.
Totally.
Especially if you have your own like, you know, business, if you're self-employed. You know, I've never had a boss, you know, like I've had like part-time, you know, with tutoring, it's probably the closest I've had to a boss was like the, you know, unit coordinator basically. But you know, she was very like chill and very like, I don't do whatever you think, basically very hands off. But aside from that, I've had thousands of tiny bosses instead, which is clients. But that freedom, but also like you're locked down in a way to some degree. Because you have like, you know, you've got to keep the machine, got to feed the beast.
Totally. Yeah. Feed the beast. That's the one that we often laugh about. And, you know, there's a saying that they talk about, you know, you create a prison of your own making.
You do. Yeah.
And you build a thing that was the thing that you always wanted that can then also trap you within that.
Yeah.
And which is the, like, it's so strange and it's not something. Because it's not something you ever talked about, and it's not something I ever even considered discussing, because the idea of any form of success was so abstract.
Yeah, it is. It is abstract, and it's not tangible until you're actually there doing it. You know, if you're not, and until you're like on a set, and even then, it doesn't feel real. Is until you're there making your first episode of a greenlit series. It's not real.
No, it's not real. It's all make-believe. It's all in your head.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And then you find yourself doing those things. And you're like, oh, whoa.
Yeah.
I'm really excited about where you're going with this, Tony. And it certainly sounds like, you know, the trajectory is there. And you know, as you're overcoming these trials and finding your way back through, is there anything in the works at the moment? I know you probably can't give away too much, but has this sort of twigged a whole idea?
Yeah, we had a creative development session just yesterday that we had for just broad projects that we think, like, basically we sat down in our meeting room and just in a whiteboard and a whole bunch of us, me and my cinematographer Brian and a writer Jesse Hughes, sat down in a room and basically just brainstormed a bunch of things, and we just were like, what do we want to make? You know, because I have a lot of passion for lots of different things, but I feel like I'm much more able to write stuff when I've got, you know, a team of people who are like, I want to read that when it's done. You know what I mean? When you know you've got a group behind you that are keen to make stuff. So like basically I said, look, let's have a little brainstorm sesh, figure out where do we want to be, who do we, you know, how do we want to be known, what are our goals, and then we were like, what sort of formats do we want to work in, and then we were like, okay, what sort of content do we want to make that fits in those formats. So it was very pragmatic, sort of outcome led sort of approach, which isn't the most like writer sort of specific way of doing things, but sometimes working within limitations is better for creativity than just going, we can just make anything. So we thought about it logically, and we were like, we would really love to you know, pitch a show for SVOD that is uniquely Australian, but also uniquely our flavor of content as well. So we were like, we want to make something, you know, weird, bold, curious, unexpected, something really sort of like, you know, odd. Possibly in like, I can't say too much because it's so
super early
days.
I don't want you to give it away.
we love the idea of doing an anthology show that we think that we could make as a first project in collaboration with maybe other Queensland sort of like filmmakers, because I love Queensland. I love, you know, the locations we've got here. I love the sort of like evolving film culture here. And I also want to do stuff that builds the community here. I think one of the pitfalls that I think, not a pitfall, I don't know. I think one of the things I don't like is that this idea that you as a director, as a writer, you soak up so much goodwill from all the people that live here. and people, you go, okay, come and work on my thing, you know, come and do a bit of, you know, just help me out with this pilot. And then that person will, you know, will make it. And then they'll be like, all right, off to LA. See you later. And I think that kind of sucks. You know what I mean? Like I would love to work in LA at some point, sure. But I want to build up the filmmaking community here and make things here. I want to live in Brisbane. I want to live in Brisbane, and I want to bring the filmmaking community together and try to make good stuff here, that like tell compelling stories here, basically, rather than just go, cool, let's make a pilot so that we can yeet out of here and make something overseas.
I'm down with that. Yeah. I did see that there was a decision at a federal level during the week that is going to, I'm not going to say encourage isn't the correct word. I think it's going to legislate that streaming services produce more local content.
Yeah, I'm cautiously optimistic about that, the content quota, because I think that on the one hand, I'm like, oh, awesome, this will be really good. But I wonder if, and I really hope this doesn't happen, but I wonder if SVODs will just be like, well, we can just make reality shows because they cost nothing. And technically, if the quota is by minute and not by dollar, I don't know. I haven't really read the legislation, so I don't know. But if it's by minute screen time versus production dollars, they'll just go, well, the easiest way to get a Australian quota done is just, you know, fund Married at First Sight for Netflix, you know, or something like that. Not poo-pooing.
No, not at all. It's got a wonderful place.
I'm sure people enjoy, it's not me, but I'm sure some people enjoy that type of content. But I just don't want it to be more reality stuff. I just want it to be good Australian written, you know, weird, creative, imaginative content that is a little bit out there and embraces the Australian sort of zaniness that we have.
Mate, I want The Late Show. I want Frontline. Yeah. I want Utopia.
Yeah.
Pretty much anything that, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I you know, talking about anthologies, I love like Black Mirror. I love like Love, Death and Robots. Anything by Charlie Brooker or Amanda Iannucci, I froth, you know. And I would love to see us make something that is like really strong creative vision that can you know, make, you know, like a Stranger Things or something like that, that people go, oh, have you seen that show? God, it's weird. And people go, fuck yeah, we made that. You know, that's what I want.
I think that's really cool. And there's something, again, there was another, SVOD?
Yeah.
Well, what's that?
Oh, streaming video on demand. So like Netflix, Stan, you know, like any Binge, all those platforms that are just streaming services.
There you go. So yeah. I'm not even down with acronyms. I don't work specifically.
It's a very janky algorithm, acronym. It doesn't exactly roll off the tongue, does it?
No, it doesn't. But you're able to sling that one pretty well. Probably better than me. You do better in those meetings. Okay, so there's some sort of anthology here working with, you know, your core team of creatives.
Yeah.
That you guys are going to bring to reality. What's the first step in something like that? Like how does that even begin to exist?
I think that the first steps for that will be getting together the people that I know will be keen to do it. And basically just coming up with ideas for episodes or ideas for, you know, like concepts. And it might be, we go, oh, anthology is not going to work. Or we might say, oh, this one idea we had for the anthology is great as a standalone show. There's a lot in this. But it's about just getting that core team together. You might say that we get together like a couple of writers and a couple of directors who we say, you know, let's come up with like 8 really good short films that are connected by a theme or a setting or a keyword. Like Love, Death and Robots, it's exactly what it says on the tin. It's got love, death or robots in it. And you don't know who's made it or like what it's about, but you're promised a good time. And that's all it needs. Or Black Mirror, you know, like you don't know what this episode's going to be about, but it's going to be fucking weird and it's going to be probably a little bit dark and maybe a little bit funny here and there, but it's going to make you think. And that, like, the appeal for me about anthologies is the freedom of narrative, the freedom of characters that you can write. You know, you're not locked into one central antagonist or protagonist for the whole thing. You can just write, you know, a character and go, cool, that's a great 10-minute episode. Maybe we'll come back to it in season 2. And then the rest of them are just totally different. And they're only connected by that sort of like brand feeling, which for me, I think is awesome.
And what are your thoughts about, you know, self-publishing?
Oh, like sort of stuff. Like if you were to independently produce it.
Or like you know, you're straight to YouTube sort of exercise. Yeah, I mean,
totally.
How would that even work? Because obviously, producer brain kicks in and you go,
how do you make this?
There's no money.
Yeah.
Idiot.
I mean, I think that like there's sort of two pathways here. The first one is you make a first season of short films that are like 5 minutes long or less, and you pitch it to YouTube. You basically go to YouTube and you either try to make it with independent financing, and just do it as like it's a whole bunch of, you know, short films basically, and we're going to put it on Shudder, or we're going to put it on you know, our own YouTube channel and or something like that, and just go, cool, it's going to live there. Or you just put together such a whiz bang pitch and such a really good like group of creatives together that, and maybe you shoot a pilot episode and you just go, here's the first episode, and the other episodes are going to be nothing like this, but this is what the show is like. And you go, here's this one. This is our quality guarantee sample that you can, you know, Netflix can taste and go, yeah, I think I'd like a little bit more of that. And then hopefully you get greenlit for a first season. But, you know, there's Screen Queensland, there's Screen Australia. They're always, you know, now, especially with you know, the new government, we are getting a lot more funding in the art space, which is terrific. So, you know, they're funding, you know, web series all the time. And even though it's probably going to come out with probably a pretty low budget, sometimes that first season's just got to be low budget. And it's not about the budget. It's about, can you tell a good story on a shoestring? And if you can do that, then maybe we'll trust you with an extra zero.
And see, that's something that it sounds like you could do.
Yeah.
Because you've got that experience and you've got that tenacity. And again, when you look back at your character arc, you can start to see where those things would all intersect.
Yeah.
And having the capacity to pull those together. Because I know you've done some sort of web series and things before. I remember.
Yeah.
Was it Overwatch?
Oh, we did. Yeah. We did a comedy pilot for like a team of salty, dysfunctional Overwatch players, and we made the pilot episode and it got like I think 50,000 or 60,000 views, which as an interesting fact, if you make a pilot for Foxtel, if you get more than 30,000 views on that Foxtel pilot on you know, on screening on Foxtel, that's considered a commercial success.
Wow.
Yeah, so like if you know, we were like, oh, here's our show and it's aimed at a bunch of nerds online, and Overwatch has a really big following, we made like one episode, and you know, as you probably know, making a fresh YouTube channel and then just like putting something on that YouTube channel, it's super difficult. You're much better off making, making like 10 3-minute episodes than you are making one 30-minute episode or whatever length you're working in, because you can release them once a week for, you know, for 10 weeks and you'll build up your audience over time, ideally. But just doing like a one-off thing is super difficult. But we did do that, and we ran into like this whole thing where, we were like, oh, it's going to be so financially unsustainable to make this because of the copyright, you know, stuff around the game, and you know, the really like muddy waters of copyright around content creation that involves video games. It's a lot clearer now, but at the time it was still like yet to be determined, like what you can and can't do in that space. Also, machinima is like a really hard work. Like making content in a video game is super difficult. But it was a really good learning experience and it was a lot of fun.
I have watched that, and
I was really proud of it. I think I had so much fun making it.
I'm actually super impressed. How many views did you say?
I think it got like 50,000 views. 50, I don't know, it's got now,
and that's on a new YouTube channel.
We released the trailer and then the episode, and it got that many. And then our other comedy pilot, which is that one, wasn't funded by Screen Queensland. That was like we made it on you know, the smell of an oily rag, or whatever the saying is, and we shot it in one weekend with a crew of like 4 or 5 people, it was super, super low. We had pizza, you know, it was super low budget, and props to the Higgins brothers that like produced that and did an awesome job, like phenomenal job. And we made that, we just launched it, and then we did our like Screen Queensland funded comedy pilot that went through workshops of like screenwriting and stuff, and you know, was made for like 5 times the budget, you know, like way, way, way higher budget, we got like, I think we got 100,000 views, which is great. It's really good for like a first one-off thing. Again, you know, your new YouTube channel. But like, you can see like dollar to view like ratio here isn't terrific.
No, it's brutal. Yeah,
it's like 50 cents a view basically.
I'm 12 months into my YouTube channel journey. Like we started one, you know, 10 years ago for the business and stuff, right. But like never did it seriously.
Yeah.
And oddly, it was my seven-year-old son going, "Dad, I'd like to have a streaming YouTube channel."
Yeah.
Because he, like, watches the gamers and stuff.
Oh, yeah, right.
And, like, oh, loves it. Like,
oh, that's great.
Loves it. And he's like, "Mom, can I start a YouTube channel?" And she's
"Oh, that's so good."
Probably not, Chief. not at this age.
Yeah. And how old is he?
He's seven.
Oh, okay, right. That's junior. That's real young. That's great.
He loves it. And yeah, he gets so up good. And, you know, performs and does all the things.
I love that. And
it sort of prompted me to go, I don't really know the experience of making one.
Yeah.
And oddly, it was that.
Yeah.
That pushed me to go, oh, bugger it. I'll just have a go at, like, just starting a YouTube channel.
That's great.
Just for the stuff I do.
Yeah.
Because I wanted a place for creative expression to make things that were reasonably unprofessional.
Hell yeah.
Not very well made, shot on phones, like really low budget stuff. I'm over 12 months, more than 60 odd pieces of content on there.
Mm.
And I think I amassed 240 subscribers in a year.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That hurts.
Does it hurt?
Brutal.
Are you making it for subscribers or are you making it for you?
I still want to see a result.
Yeah, that's true.
That's the problem.
That's true. I'm being like idealistic here. Like
you look at the metric.
You want people to look at it.
But you want people to, particularly, so there's bits and pieces in there that, you know, you're really proud of.
Yeah.
And you go, that's a nice piece of content.
Yeah.
And nobody sees it.
Yeah. It's super like.
That part of it is disheartening.
Yeah.
Whereas I look at it more broadly as like a 3-year project to go.
Yeah, totally.
You know, and there's a fellow that shoots for me that has a very big following, and he told me that it took him about 4 years of just constant until I think he's up to 70,000 or something now.
Oh, that's great.
And you know, so it sort of popped.
It's so competitive.
So competitive.
And like, I've got a friend who Daniel Warner, who's an editor who runs a YouTube channel called Simply Hiking. Shout out to Dan Warner and Simply Hiking. And it's just like, it's called Slow TV. The type of content is called Slow TV, where it's him and a camera and a gimbal. And he walks up hikes and just records the entire thing. And it's just a beautiful steady shot with just beautiful like light. You know, he'll do it at like 7 a.m. so you get the beautiful like morning light. And just the sound, he has a little like audio pack mounted on his backpack, you know, with the mic pointed down and another one pointed up. And he gets like this beautiful like recording of the you know, the boots crunching on the gravel and like the, you know, the sound of birds. And, you know, you're living in Tasmania now and doing it all there in these beautiful locations. And his channel is just him walking through, you know, with the camera facing this way, just a beautiful like uninterrupted shot of just this you know, hiking trail. And I don't know how he goes for views, but he does really well. And like, people love that stuff. They just put it on in like in the background of their shop or you know, just in the background of when they're doing work and just enjoy the ambience. So
I've never even heard of something like that.
It's so odd. Yeah.
Sorry, what was the channel called?
Simply Hiking.
Simply Hiking.
And it's exactly what it says on the tin.
It is Simply Hiking. I'm going to have to look that up and have a look. Cool. Does he actually hold the gimbal?
He had like a rig at one stage. I think he holds a lot of the time, but he just a mirrorless camera. So super light, but he just, you know, and he's a very fit dude. So like he's either holding it or it's like rigged up. I think he had like an almost like a sort of like ad hoc sort of steady cam sort of set up at one point where it was just like holding the weight of it. But like, it's just a simple shot, you know, the whole time, really nice and steady and smooth, making your way up the side of a mountain, for, you know, an hour and a half. And then little titles that appear that explain where he is and what he's doing and that sort of stuff. But it's the most like wholesome shit ever.
That's so cool.
It's so good. Yeah.
I dig that. The first thing I was thinking was like, man, I don't want to hold a bloody camera for I was like, that totally needs a body mount.
Yeah. His arms are like thick as. Yeah. But there's audiences everywhere. And like, you've heard of the guinea pig rule. You ever heard of that?
I have not. Educate me.
That's a rule that I picked up from the guys at Changer Studios when they were doing one of their YouTube things. It's like one of the things I took away from that was that if you're going to do a new podcast, you know, channel or a YouTube channel or a podcast, something like that, and you're like, okay, I want to make a podcast about Australian politics, and this is my take on you know, Australian politics and whatever, right? That's like one audience in one country. Probably in one state of one country, and you know, and that maybe one age demographics. So it's quite narrow, And you know, you're gonna, maybe if you're really successful, like if you're like a Friendly Geordies or someone like that, you might like get heaps of subscribers if you're really, really like the top 1%. But the guinea pig principle is sort of the inverse of that. It's the idea that like a niche hobby that exists everywhere is going to do better than one hobby that's kind of popular in one particular area. So like the idea that if you start a YouTube channel about guinea pigs, chances are that your capacity to grow as a channel is going to be a lot higher because, you know, people have guinea pigs in the Netherlands and they have guinea pigs in, you know, in France and in New Zealand. And like, you know, people who are interested in guinea pigs exist all over the world. And so your capacity to grow as a channel is actually not limited to one particular region. So there you go. Guinea pig principle.
See, I really dig that. And yeah, that cool. Also makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it does.
Because that's part of the joy of the internet is whatever stupid thing you're interested in. I love like the hyper focused community.
Right, right. Like you could do a channel on like I don't know what your channel is about, but like photography of like cars, like yeah, shooting like race cars and stuff, right?
This is my channel, subtle plug.
Oh cool, cool.
We are living the dream.
Living the dream. What's it about?
About living the dream.
Oh, nice.
And living the dream to me is the outdoors.
Yeah, nice.
Cool. Four-wheel driving. Crappy old cars.
Yeah, nice.
Going places.
Okay, cool.
Friends, joy, beautiful days.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's
great.
That's my happy place.
Yeah, nice. So that's great. So you're appealing to that sort of like lifestyle sort of audience that yeah, like it's just like, I just want to learn about going out and you know, weekends away on the four-wheel drive.
Yeah, lifestyle and then just crappy old cars.
Yeah, nice.
That's my jam.
Yeah, cool, cool.
I enjoy that part of it.
Hell yeah.
It's probably not niche enough. It's actually fairly broad.
Maybe. That's okay. I mean, you can always niche it up. You can always be like, oh, I want to get exclusively into like the ins and outs of like four-wheel driving because like, you know, people four-wheel drive in, you know, Africa and South America and everywhere. So I don't know. Maybe that's
I'm just not a very good driver though.
That's right.
Yeah. Do you know what it is? It's probably more the romantic notion of, you know, the ideas and the planning and the where you want to go and
yeah, yeah,
how you need to set up your vehicle. And,
yeah.
You know, being able to live out of it and cook out of it and all that sort of stuff. And
yeah,
then
yeah,
being able to go there and then execute sort of as you have seen in your mind's eye is probably as close as an explanation as I get. I don't know if I've ever really even thought about trying to explain it.
But you're making, I think it sounds like you're making this stuff for you, like which is awesome. I think that's terrific.
And I think that's my guinea pig principle. It's even the same as this podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
So it sort of started initially as a thing for Brisbane Small Business where I was trying to, you know, share stuff.
Hmm.
And then I'm like, I just want to talk to people. And
that's
I just want
great.
To learn stuff for me. And I just want to talk to people, you know, because I dig their vibe.
That's great.
And that's the whole goal. Like I'm the audience. It's an audience of one.
Hmm.
If anybody else finds it interesting, then that's cool.
Nice. That's good. That's the right attitude to have. And you got to make stuff for yourself.
You got to make stuff for yourself. And I keep hearing that. I keep hearing that in particular from people who have probably been through a similar journey.
Yeah.
Going, just make stuff you like.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't think about the audience. Don't think about if you just make it for you.
Yeah.
And if you love it and you think it's beautiful, it goes back to what you were talking about as, you know, that fire inside.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just make something that you love.
That's great. I mean, I think it's great. I think that if you can, and maybe if you wanted to expand it like a tiny bit further, you might say, I'm making this for me and my five friends that I play D&D with. And it's like, and that's it. Like, that's like anyone else. I don't care what anyone else thinks. I'm not going to post about this on Instagram very much. Or I'm not going to like publish it. I'm never going to publish my D&D stuff anywhere. Cause like, it's not for anyone else. It's, my dad, you know, said to me, and I love this. It's not how I think about things, but I appreciate the thought. He said, can you think of a way of selling it? Can you write the D&D episodes up as like, you know, modules that people can download and buy? And I was like, oh yeah, I mean, I guess I could. I've made the maps and I've made the story and I've set up, you know, I could just put it to a PDF and just put it online for a few bucks. Sure. But I'm also like, I don't know if I want to, like, cause it's like, you know, not everything has to be commercialized. You can just make it for yourself and just enjoy the fact that you had a great time doing it. And not everything, not every hobby you make has to be a passive income, because sometimes commercializing things is the quickest way to kill something you like.
And I think that's what it does, is it kills the fun.
Yeah.
And that's part of the joy of like even this, because I'm probably more of a pictures guy, like from a stills background.
Yeah.
Sound is not my jam.
Right.
And so the idea of setting up a podcast was like weird.
Yeah.
Because I don't know sound stuff. Like I understand basics of, you know, levels and gain and a few other, you know, I could just say some sound words.
Yeah.
But the idea of actually making something close to commercial grade sound was surprisingly difficult. And I was, you know, looking at all the different options, because when I started doing this, I was just using my mobile phone.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Nice.
And, you know, audio is questionable.
Yeah.
But it's pretty good, because I mean you've probably run the, you know, you can throw a microphone into them and stuff.
Oh, I love it.
You know, I've used them as a spare.
Oh, dude, it's great. We've
yeah, got it's in trouble.
It's fine. And like, you know, you've got the Rode mics now, and like the little DJI mic kits that you can plug straight in there and use, and it's bloody great.
Yeah, but once you get into it, and then you sort of start the next part of the journey was actually listening to your own voice.
Yeah,
that's terrible.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really off-putting.
Like, it's super off-putting.
I'm really pushing through just listening to my voice.
Yeah, and it's weird when you hear yourself, you know, in your ears, and you're like, hang on, do I really sound like this?
It's really weird.
And then even just the process of listening to how you talk to people.
Yeah.
And it was something my brother pointed out to me, because, you know, when you're just standing chatting to somebody, you tend to make noises. You're like,
And oh, like I'm doing right now. Yeah.
Correct. And you do that, whereas when you're actually interviewing people, if you make those noises, it's super weird as a listener to have you going, So I now find myself here, I'm doing the noddies. So I do the noddies to acknowledge, but I've had to practice not making the sound.
You know, now that you've said it, I'm super self-conscious of it now. But I realized that like I'm conscious of that when I'm doing video, but only until you've said it just then that I've been conscious of doing that in audio. Like when I'm shooting interviews with people, you know, for Doco or for corporate stuff, being conscious of not going, yes, yeah. Like all the time, I constantly, because you want it socially, you do that, right? Consciously not doing that in videos, I've mastered that. Like I'm great at like non-verbal body language now to encourage people and go do the nod and do the sort of like little eyebrow or like a little, you know, a little squint or like a little like, you know, people can't see this, but like leaning back slightly in my chair and sort of nodding slightly. That's, you know, little things like that just to sort of, you know.
The faces of acknowledgement. And that's the same thing. I had one of my, you know, before I sort of started doing the podcast thing a bit more seriously, one of my cinematographers was like, you know, with the interviewing, he's like, you're very comfortable with that. And I'm like, yeah, man, it's just from years and years of standing next to a camera, having people that are like super freaked out to be on camera and doing like the big smiley face and going, you know, you're doing a great job and really encouraging them without using your words. Mm. And you don't realize how much you hone, I guess, those soft skills over the process. And see now, Tony is actually doing the noddies to me because he's now super conscious of the capacity to not speak in the breaks over the
I'm glad that I'm learning things though, and I feel like this podcast has been all about learnings.
Honestly, that's it, and this is, you know, the reason it exists. And you know, I feel that we are actually near the end of this arc. I feel like we've been through the whole journey here. Tony, I'm very interested to see where you go with this.
Yeah.
I really am keen to follow where this goes next. So I hope you keep us updated. I look forward to, you know, securing an interview with you after your show's picked up.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'd love that. I'd love to come back and do a redux of this interview once we can say, hey, remember that that little podcast episode we did in February? Well, it's February of 2024, and we've made the first few episodes of this anthology series or whatever it is we decided to do. I guess watch this space in the meantime.
See, I totally dig that.
Yeah.
Now, Tony, if people want to follow you around the internet and follow your adventures, where can they hunt you down?
They can follow the company, which is Stranger Films. It's not Stranger Things. We had the name first before the TV show came around. Stranger Films, we're based in Brisbane, so should be easy to find. Or Tony Walsh, my Instagram handle is TonesText2.
Tony, it has been an absolute delight to have you here on the show with me today. I've really enjoyed our meandering conversation. Thank you for taking the time to come and share that with me.
It's been a wonderful time, Scott Nelson. Thanks so much.
All right. Well, that's it. We're going to leave it there. We're 1 minute and 43 into this. I'm going to play some tunes and see you out. Catch you next time.
dangerous.